to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Over the past 4 years, 81 suicides of inmates have been reported in Pennsylvania's county jails. And there may be more because some suicides may not have been reported as suicides. Either way, the percentage of those behind bars taking their own lives is much higher than the general population. PA Post reporter Ed Mahan has investigated and is with us today. Ed, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. We'll be joined in just a few minutes by Brenda Peniak, who is the Deputy Director of the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania, and Claire Schubick-Richards, who is Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Prisons Society. They'll be with us in just a moment as well. Ed, let's start with some of the basics with your reporting. And this is an extensive report that you have done. You looked at suicides and other deaths in county jails. Generally, what did you find?
We found that, as you mentioned, 81 suicides reported by county jails, and then about 123 other deaths. And most of them were labeled as natural. The other categories are homicide and accidental, but the majority were reported as natural deaths. And then last year, there were more than 200 attempted suicides reported in county jails.
And looking at the figures, by the way, when you go to papost.org and see Ed's story, there's a lot of data there.
Yeah.
Maps of the county prisons, where they're located, and if you click on the dots there, you can find out how many suicides and attempts and that kind of thing. But we'll be looking at a lot of statistics today, but one thing that stuck out to me as I looked over your story is that the number of attempted suicides last year was way up by like 40 or 50 compared to other years.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things with that, the information is reported by counties, and there's, you know, we have 67 counties in the state, and they all, the ones that have jails, all report this information. You know, we talked to officials in Montgomery County and in Berks County. They both had more than 100 attempted suicides over the time period, but they were ranked high for the attempted suicides. And they said that they have a higher threshold for what they essentially consider to be an attempted suicide. So, and some counties had very few reported attempted suicides over the 4 years. So you get into this question of, are inmates there more likely to attempt suicide, or is it being treated more seriously in those facilities?
Well, and that leads to a question. What doesn't the data show us? I have to, again, something that really sticks out in this report is that where some counties a suicide is reported as natural, obviously a suicide is not a natural death.
Oh, so there's suicide, natural, accidental, and homicide. So the suicides aren't reported as natural. It's just, but the natural deaths can be, if there's a unknown cause of death. I talked to officials in York County, and you know they had a death that they still haven't determined the actual cause, but they reported it as natural because they didn't know what else to report it as. And the other factor is this all relies on counties reporting the information. And so we, you know, in York County, for instance, I noticed that the number of deaths they reported last year was fewer than what I read in news accounts. And so I reached out to them. They said, you know, we missed them. And then they ended up updating their numbers as well. So when we don't have names, we don't have ages, we don't have how long they've been in the facility, which would be really valuable to know, because a lot of times suicides in county jails occur within the first 2 weeks or so. That's according to, you know, national data. That gets into the why we would like to know how long they've been in there, because that gets into questions of, you know, is there something you're doing in the processing of flagging for risk that could be changed to identify people earlier on in the process who would be at risk for suicides?
What doesn't the data show us?
So it doesn't show the names, ages, and it doesn't show some of those key demographic data that would help us better understand.
Well, let's bring in Brenda Peniak, who is Deputy Director of the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania. Brenda, thank you very much for being with us today. I'll ask the question of you. Why isn't there uniform reporting amongst Pennsylvania's 67 counties? I say 67, not all counties have jails. But why is there uniform reporting to I don't even know who the reports go to, but when it comes to suicide and manner of death.
Right. Well, thank you, first of all, for the opportunity to participate today. I can't speak so much about why an individual county might report differently. The structure, though, for regulating that comes from the Department of Corrections. The reports would go to the Department of Corrections.
Okay.
And because we have a very diverse state, each county is its own government, the regulatory structure for the DOC over the county jails is essentially one of making sure that the counties have policies in place, more so than dictating, you know, what the form would look like or, you know, some of the details of that. But I think one of the things that is very much of interest to us, not in any way trivializing the suicide, huge, very traumatic issue, but it really does call into question why we're seeing the jail populations with behavioral health issues, mental health, substance abuse issues on the rise. And that's something that I do believe you will hear consistently from every jail administrator and county commissioner across the state. Not statistics so much, but what they are actually seeing in terms of those populations and the conditions that they're in when they come to the jail.
Is that what you attribute this increasing suicide rate to and attempted suicide, that county jails are seeing many more inmates who may be suffering from mental illness or substance abuse?
It has to be part of it. You know, we've seen a significant increase over the last 15 to 20 years in the number of inmates who are coming to us with serious mental illness and the number of inmates who are coming to us with long-term substance abuse or a combination of both. The sector of the population in county jails that's growing the fastest are those with behavioral health issues. So it would seem to match that statistical pattern that you would see more individuals with suicide ideation or considering that as part of their life.
Claire Schubick-Richards, you're the executive director of the Pennsylvania Prison Society, and reading Ed Mahan's report, I saw a quote that said something similar, that is one of the reasons that you attribute the high suicide rate. Tell us a little bit about it. Why do you think that there are so many inmates who are taking their own lives and attempting to take their own lives in county lockups?
I think there are a number of factors in play. Obviously, the prevalence of serious mental health issues is one. Another issue is the issue of detoxing. That comes into play not only with suicide, but also with just the overall number of deaths in county facilities. And deaths due to detox usually occur within the first 3 days of someone being in a county facility. And then there's just, quite honestly, the bleak and scary outlook of being locked up behind bars with a very dismal future ahead of you.
So, you know, Ed mentioned, and I'm sure you're aware of this statistic, that most of the suicides occur within the first 2 weeks of being incarcerated. And that would seem to explain some of the things that you just listed. Is that, that sounds like this is a time during those first 2 weeks where staff should be paying particular attention to new inmates.
Yes, absolutely. And many facilities do a very good job of attempting to assess and triage, but it also requires having the support available for somebody who is in a fragile or dangerous situation. So it's one thing to assess. I mean, one of the issues, and we tried to tease this out in some research that we did recently, was the role of solitary. A response to someone in a fragile or dangerous situation for many county prisons is to put the individual in solitary, which in fact can exacerbate mental health concerns or concerns for their own safety. But without appropriate mental health and health care options, that's what many county facilities end up doing.
When you say without adequate options, Brenda Peniak, let me turn to you. In Pennsylvania's counties, I mean, we all know that money is a real issue, especially when you're talking about county jails. So is that an issue? If there was more funding, is this something that could be prevented?
Well, I think it's much broader than that. There's a couple of factors at play here. In the first place, county jails were never meant to be treatment facilities. So you don't see traditionally the kinds of things that would be used to address, long-term or to a deeper degree, serious mental illness and substance abuse in facilities. The ability to assess is an absolute, to get some treatment where possible, absolute. But also, more than money, we've really seen a shift in how individuals are finding their way into the criminal justice system as a result of their substance abuse or as a result of their mental health status. So, again, it's not just money. It's lack of adequate resources in the community before somebody finds themselves to be criminally involved. And that's where we really think that there has to be more of a joint effort. While you're looking at the suicide issue and the statistical issue, that is, clearly something that arises out of our inability to pay enough attention to the needs of individuals in the community with mental health needs, and to really start creating some focus for folks before they become engaged with the criminal justice system.
I'm curious, when you say that we're finding new ways to become, people are finding more ways to become involved in the criminal justice system, what do you mean by that?
Well, if somebody is mentally ill and on the streets and is a nuisance perhaps in the community or seen that way, and law enforcement doesn't have any place else to take this person because there aren't community-based mental health or substance abuse services that can be accessed, the jail may be the only place that they can be safely supervised and held. And that's not necessarily the right reason to use a jail, but in some ways it's the default reason because other resources doesn't exist. Just one example.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk on this segment of today's program. We're talking about suicides in Pennsylvania's county jails, actually talking about a lot of issues having to do with county jails. Joining us, Ed Mahan, who is reporter with the PA Post, Brenda Peniak, Deputy Director of the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania, Claire Schubick-Richards, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Prison Society. We're taking your phone calls, 1-800-729-7532. You can email a question or comment to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Before we get back into our discussion, just remind you of some upcoming topics on Smart Talk. We're going to be talking about the Pennsylvania's hemp crop that is coming up, also a shortage of police officers, and Charter Day in Pennsylvania, which is this weekend. We'll be talking to someone about William Penn, not exactly someone that you know a whole lot about, and really some things that may surprise you about Pennsylvania's founder. That's coming up a little bit later. Plus, you can leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. And I'm going to pose this question. We have a question from Jerry. It's a very good question, by the way. If individuals are placed in jail with previous mental health and prescribed medications, do they have access to continued medication? Brenda and Claire, either one of you could probably answer that question. Do they have access to their medication?
Often, no.
Go ahead.
That's the short answer. There are many facilities that may attempt to, but the short answer is particularly around the time of intake before the jail has done their own assessment. Typically, no. And then there is the additional issue of, a break in medication is a fairly frequent occurrence. And then the issue is once an assessment is done and medication may be started, it is often not the medication that the person was used to receiving on the outside. Many facilities restrict which medications they use. They don't have access to the same array that one would have at a pharmacy on the outside. And so an individual who has been receiving a certain medication for a mental illness may receive a different medication once they've spent some time locked up.
Brenda, that would seem to be a real problem.
And I would say it's a problem until we've fully assessed and identified what the individual may need. And the other part of that problem is we often don't know.
Well, that's what I can see how difficult that would be.
Absolutely. And the physicians within the facilities who are working with individuals often develop protocols based on their ability to treat and manage the inmates within the facility. And, I don't disagree. Oftentimes it's different or a different medication. And, there needs to be an opportunity to take a look at all of the health conditions that the individual is presenting with when they come in the door. If you're getting folks who have been homeless or who haven't been in a supportive environment for a long time, which is often what we see with inmates who have mental illness, there are some things that are likely to be missed and things not necessarily shared by the inmate themselves if they're able to even talk with a great deal of certainty about what types of treatment they've received. But again, it goes back in many ways to the need to take a look at our community system, our community mental health system, and our community substance abuse support system, and make sure that those are able to keep people from entering the jail system in the first place wherever possible. But the continuity is also important.
Well, Claire, I mean, that would seem to be a challenge. That is there an answer to that? I mean, as you know, just the scenario that Brenda laid out there, how is the county jail, even if there is substantial or sufficient medical personnel and they're paying attention to the inmates, it'd be very difficult to tell what medications there are, what the condition is. And again, this goes back to those first 2 weeks and how important that is for trying to determine what's going on. But is there an answer to that, Claire?
Well, there's a global answer, and that's a long-term one, and there's a shorter-term one. And Brenda is really pointing at the longer-term one. So to put this in perspective, there are about 35,000 people incarcerated in Pennsylvania County jails in a given day. That's 35,000 people spread across 62 county jails in a given day. That jail population has seen a 450% increase since the mid 80s. So if we look at, say, 1988, there were 15,000 people in Pennsylvania's prisons and jails. And now there are 35,000. So there's just been a ballooning of people being incarcerated in county prisons. And while we've seen a dip in that population in the last several years, the opioid epidemic is questioning whether the upward trajectory is going to continue. So the first obvious statement, which I think Brenda is really pointing at, is that jails were not built to be mental health institutions. And so to the extent that the suicides that that Ed has been reporting on are the result of mental illness, one has to ask, why shouldn't people with mental illness be responded to differently than being placed in a law enforcement restrictive environment that's going to exacerbate issues they're presenting with? In the shorter term, the answer is, well, we've got this population in Pennsylvania's prisons and jails. And Pennsylvania's prisons and jails are being asked to be a mental health provider. But they're not really set up to be, and they're not really funded to be. And so to the extent that we care about the survival and health of our fellow citizens who may end up behind bars, there needs to be some type of investment and look at how folks are being treated. And yes, to the point, people coming in homeless, people coming in without supports, it can be very, very difficult to try and understand what, if any, medication they may have been on. But then there are also people who come in who will document what medication they've been on, who may be represented by attorneys. And even in those cases, And it makes sense from the perspective of the institution to do their own assessment and provide the medication that they're allowed to provide. But even in those cases, often medication gets dropped for some period of time. Mm.
Ed, let me bring it back into the conversation here. The research that you did, I'm curious, why is there a greater risk of suicide at county jails?
And so the greater risk in the compared to the general population and also compared to state prisons. There's a higher suicide rate in county jails nationally than you have in state prisons. And, you know, regardless of the actual county jail, that's generally attributed to two big reasons. One is what we've kind of talked about is there's a shock to the system. And, you know, some people going to county jail might not have been in county jail before. And so there's that factor. And the other factor is when they're transferred to a state prison, that's after they've been convicted of a crime. You know, there's been this time to do all of these assessments that we've talked about. And so state prisons will have a better idea of who they're getting and the problems that they might have.
You know, and I don't want to have to base this question on anecdotes or anecdotal evidence or anything, but, you know, we've often heard that state prisons are more dangerous for inmates than county jails, because as you had just suggested, that these are people who have been convicted, and you know, this is where the more serious crimes, the people who have been convicted of those crimes, more serious crimes, go to state prison. So I'm a little curious about why. Why the state prison population doesn't have a suicide rate as high as the county prison. And let me go back to you, Claire. Is that because of what you've suggested, the mental health aspect of it, the substance abuse, the shock to the system? I mean, let's face it, no prison is a safe place, but it would seem that when you hear those who are in the criminal justice system say they would rather be incarcerated in a county jail than in the state prison, that seems to say that they feel safer or more secure in a county lockup.
Well, often people prefer to be it's hard to say prefer because no one wishes to be incarcerated. But if somebody is facing a period of being deprived of their liberty, often they would rather have access to their family and their support networks than be sent 5, 6, 7, 8 hours away where they will not be able to stay in touch with their support networks. And that is why people, if they have the ability to express a preference, will prefer to be incarcerated in their county lockup, because that allows them to stay in contact and receive visits from friends and family. So, for example, at the Prison Society, about 40% of people incarcerated in state prisons come from southeast Pennsylvania, but only 15% of state prison beds are in southeast Pennsylvania. So for those folks from southeast Pennsylvania who end up in state prison, they're likely going to be 2, 5, 8 hours away from home. At the Prison Society, with help from the Department of Corrections, we charter 10 buses a month for family members in southeast Pennsylvania to go visit their loved ones far away. For many people, the only way they ever see somebody in their lives, a father, a son, a brother, a mother, is from the Prison Society buses. We visit each prison every other month, and that's it. That's your only chance. So the reason why people prefer the county is because they want to stay in touch with their family, their loved ones, their support networks. Mm-hmm.
Other issues, Ed, what's being done to, and I'll bring Brenda in this as well, but what's being done to prevent suicides at county jails?
Yeah, you're seeing a wide variety across the state. I mean, in some state areas, it's getting more attention. In Allegheny County, there's been debates about whether to do a reassessment, a formal reassessment of how to proceed, how to best prevent these suicides. And part of the reason we did this story is to help bring attention to every area of the state, you know, areas that might not be getting as much attention as, you know, Allegheny County, which has had 7 suicides over 3 years. And you know, I talked with someone else from the County Commissioners Association, and he talked about sort of some of the facilities challenges, you know, older facilities. There's issues with, you know, how much sight lines and communications, there are just more challenges in that respect too. Mm.
So Brenda, let me bring you into that too. What is being done? You know, Ed listed some of the things, but what are some, obviously this is something you said earlier that counties take very seriously, but obviously there's a problem. So what are counties doing to prevent this from happening?
Sure. Well, county jail operations are changing, along with many other things that are within their purview. And understanding what their challenges are is one of the things that they're starting to address from a policy level. Also, we've started to work much more closely with the Department of Corrections and share resources where possible. And when I say resources, I mean mostly best practices, training and education, bringing staff within the facilities up to speed on how best to do care, custody, and control in certain circumstances. So, you know, in an environment where we don't have unlimited resources and we don't have state support for these facilities, we try to use partnership, training, and understanding as the best way to improve things. You know, also, I know you talked with an individual from CCAP last week. Through some of the access that we have with our support systems for the jails, providing them with information on how they could be a little bit more efficient or effective given the facility challenges that they face. Some of those things obviously can't be changed. You can't reconstruct a wing of an old building, but there are some best practices that can be put into place. So training, education, awareness, all of those things.
And I'll just jump into there. You know, there's money at risk for potential lawsuits as well for counties. I think in Delaware County 2 years ago, there was a suicide lawsuit ended with a $7 million settlement. In Lebanon County, I think last year, it wasn't a suicide case, but it was a death case that ended with about a $5 million settlement. So some of those cases can, counties don't want to, the counties don't want to have to pay that money. And so that might be a factor too. And sort of changes as well.
Brenda, we've heard the term suicide watch. I assume that there are some inmates when they come into county jails are put on suicide watch. What does that entail? Meaning, what would an inmate, someone coming into the system, what would make the decision that they'd say, okay, we have to watch this inmate closely? And what does suicide watch entail?
Well, I think it's going to differ in every single case, but when the initial entry assessment is done, what indicators they may see or find out during that time, or perhaps it's somebody who's been in the jail before, somebody that the administrators know. And again, it's going to be a case-by-case scenario based on the individual and not so much related to a standard policy, although the assessment is the standard policy.
But when you say that, a case-by-case basis, that sounds kind of hit or miss.
Well, you know, you're talking about human beings and how human beings are reacting to the situation and circumstances they find themselves in. So there would be procedures, obviously, on how to assess the circumstances of a given individual that would then, you know, trigger certain types of supervision. But again, every individual is different. And as Claire pointed out, you know, there are certain things that could be used that could create a bigger problem. You know, you certainly don't want to put somebody who has a mental illness in a situation that's going to exacerbate their situation. So you really do have to take a look at the circumstances in the individual and make some decisions on that basis.
Claire, I mean, obviously this is not, as Brenda just said, these are human beings. You never know how they're going to react to a different situation. But in your mind, the prison society, I don't know if you have a policy about this or advocate recommendation. Do you think that there's a better way to do this?
So at the Prison Society, you know, we're the oldest human rights organization in the country, right? Founded in 1787 by Benjamin Franklin. And our mission since 1787 has been to work to ensure humane prison conditions. You know, we are based on the idea that the obligations of benevolence are not canceled by the follies and crimes of our fellow creatures. That's Rush's words in 1787. And so treating people's health issues and their mental health issues as health issues and mental health issues is the stance that we take, that every individual needs the support and care that as a baseline they deserve. And so I think Brenda brought this up at the beginning. Using incarceration and restrictive settings for people with mental illness is not humane, fundamentally. Sometimes it's necessary. It's certainly necessary in this moment, but it is not humane. And so what we really advocate for at this juncture, given the explosive growth in incarceration in Pennsylvania, is first and foremost an increase in health and mental health investment in the prisons. Absolutely, absolutely. The prisons actually shouldn't be a health care provider and a mental health care provider, and there should be more supports in the community. But in the absence of those supports and with the prison doors open 24 hours at this moment, we really, really urge counties to invest and examine their provision of mental and basic medical care in the county prisons.
Well, the counties have a real issue with funding when it comes to that, but all right, I'm not going to answer for them. We're almost out of time for this portion. Claire Schubick-Richards, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Prison Society, Brenda Peniak, Deputy Director of the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania, thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Ed, just going to let you wrap up this segment. Tell our listeners out there, if you would, how they can learn more at papost.org.
We have a map with every county facility in the state. You can go click on the little dot there. You can get more information about the county jail there. And what I talked about with Claire was that earlier in the reporting process was that, you know, looking at some of these counties, you can flag problem areas. You can ask more questions. And, you know, maybe, and since it's up to the counties about what they report, maybe you'll see something that's missing. You can flag it for us, flag it for the county, the state. And we're hoping to do some more reporting on this.
Ed Mahan, PA Post reporter, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Listen tomorrow for Smart Talk when we talk about the hemp crop in Pennsylvania making a comeback here in Pennsylvania. So that's an interesting topic that's coming up on tomorrow's show. Plus, you can leave a voicemail or a voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs like tomorrow. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. Budget hearings are wrapping up this week at the state capitol. The hearings in front of legislative committees are often instructive in that they will identify an agency or a lawmaker's priorities. Last week, it was the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services that had a budget hearing. A few newsworthy items came out of that. Joining us to tell us a little bit more is Brett Schultes, WITF's Transforming Health reporter. Brett, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Great to be here on this snowy morning.
Well, you're painting a picture out there. Theater of the mind. It's radio. Yeah. You know, the roads are really good, though, considering how much snow we got.
The roads weren't
night.
Too bad, yeah.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk. WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, let me start with the big question. As I mentioned, budget hearing last week for Pennsylvania's Department of Human Services, one of the agencies that spends the most money.
That's right.
And does probably more things than any other agency compared to, I don't know if I can say that accurately, but let's face it, human services, there's a lot that falls under human services. So generally, the broad question, what did you learn at that budget hearing?
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, it's a $34 billion budget, and I think about $8.4 billion of that, at least last year, was just Medicaid alone, which, of course, Department of Human Services oversees. So you're totally right to say that it's a big department. And so, as is always the case, hearings are both a chance for officials to kind of tout some of their successes and set their priorities, but also for legislators to view that through the lens of what their priorities are as well. So one of the first things that really came up to me was being thrown into this perennial conversation about work requirements for a lot of public assistance programs. And this is nothing new. But this is something that will be new again for 2019.
All right. Well, let me ask that question. What will be new? Because, yeah, I think back to when Bill Clinton was president of the United States, on a federal level, there were work requirements tied into welfare reform, mm-hmm. as it was called then. Here on the state level, this has been discussed very, very often. So what's new?
One thing that that popped up during budget hearings was Senator David Argel of Schuylkill County focused in on SNAP benefits, because SNAP benefits, of course, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, formerly called food stamps, reaches about 1.8 million people in Pennsylvania. And he took issue with the fact that a lot of counties have gotten waivers for work requirements for certain people who are on SNAP benefits. So I'll try to cut through some of this detail here. But basically, out of that 1.8 million people who are on SNAP benefits in Pennsylvania, there's about 167,000 of them that are classified as able-bodied adults without dependents. So, you know, about one in every 10. And SNAP, let's keep in mind, is a federally funded program. So it's not state taxpayer dollars, but it is taxpayer dollars. It is federal. That's what funds that. Now, for that program, you have to have a work. There is a work requirement.
Right. And that goes back to the 90s with the Clinton administration.
It does. But counties can apply for, the state actually can apply for specific waivers for specific counties. So, you know, this is why this gets so interesting, is because it really is sort of two different philosophies as to what the role of human services should be and what the role of work should be, I think, among our population. Because with speaking with Deputy Secretary Lisa Watson, she really made it clear, and this is something that DHS Secretary Teresa Miller said as well, that they think that, a work requirement is actually sometimes an obstacle to someone kind of lifting themselves out of poverty and maybe getting more education, maybe ultimately getting a higher paying job. So their approach is they're going to apply for work requirement waivers in every instance that they think they might get one. And so as a result of that, over recent years, if you look at the year-over-year comparisons, you know, fewer and fewer counties still had that work requirement left. Till now, we've gotten to the point where it's, I believe, 63 counties have that waiver. So that, what that means is that out of that 167,000 people, those who are in those counties do not have to work. That doesn't mean they aren't working, by the way.
They don't have to work in order to get SNAP benefits.
That's right. Okay. That's right. So why does this, why does this concern, Senator Argel? I reached out to him. And again, it goes back to, because this year he is co-sponsoring a bill that will be very familiar to people who watched this play out last year and the year before that, which was, now, this particular bill, this is where it gets, tricky. This particular bill is not for SNAP benefits, but he has a proposal to have a work requirement for Medicaid. And that is something we saw in 2017, something we saw in 2018, both times vetoed by Governor Wolf. But it's been a recurring, Republican proposal, is to set that work requirement up again for a certain subset of people who are on Medicaid. There is a lot of overlap between those who are on Medicaid and SNAP, but it is two different things, of course.
You know, I'm trying to look at both sides of this argument. There would be those that would say that what the department is arguing of why some of these waivers are granted, that it's counterintuitive, that looking for a job or looking for something to provide an income is a barrier to getting out of poverty. I mean, that's not, I mean, mm-hmm. let's face it, a lot of jobs, this goes to the minimum wage debate, but a lot of jobs, maybe part-time, don't pay a lot of money and still are difficult to get out of poverty. But isn't that, I mean, this goes back to the general idea behind public assistance, is it's not supposed to be permanent, but to hold someone over until they can find a job making a decent income.
That's a really interesting point, and I feel like I'm kind of able to sort of see both of those sides of it as well whenever I report on it, because it is a multifaceted issue. You bring up the idea of public assistance being kind of temporary, not something that a person is on, you know, interminably for life.
That's what it was designed to do, yeah.
Right, and so and that was something that Senator Argo actually brought up with regard to the work requirement waivers, because he says that, you know, those were initially set up for, okay, if you're in a county where jobs are hard to come by and the economy's bad and there just aren't a lot of opportunities, and maybe you have some additional barriers as well. Maybe you only have maybe you don't even have a GED. Maybe you have very spotty or very little work record, or maybe a criminal past, you know, a lot of barriers to employment. So they sort of said, we're going to look at this on a county by county basis, and that's why we're going to grant these waivers in the first place. So from his perspective, I think he sees the sort of proliferation of these waivers in, across the counties as one way that they're not being used in the original spirit of them being sort of temporary. So, you know, to his point, the economy's better than it had been in, you know, 2008, 2009. Unemployment is down. There are more jobs available. If you want to talk about the other end of it, listening to Secretary Miller, and she did give a lot of testimony on this, because this is one of those issues that keeps coming up when they look at a lot of different aspects of DHS's programs and mission, you know, SNAP, Medicaid, you know, CHIP, other programs. And so she really says that the research they did showed that work requirements, it's sort of like get somebody to work, maybe what they kind of called like a cashier type job, or
retail
job or fast food job. So somebody's working an hourly, maybe minimum wage job, and they're always still just one or two steps away from, you know, a couple things go wrong and then they end up losing that job. So they saw it as a sort of a cycle that was preventing, it was so time consuming and so, you know, they were so busy with that that they weren't really able to focus on what DHS believes people should be focusing on, which is kind of getting more certifications, training, overcoming some of those barriers, such as maybe you don't have a high school diploma, such or a GED, or don't have childcare. You know, focusing on overcoming some of those barriers and getting people into more stable employment.
Yeah, well, and let's face it, many people would like to see this as a cut and dried thing. Oh, you want to make more money, you want to get out of poverty, you get a job, that's how you do it. But
right,
just the things you listed, I mean, just two that really stick out are if you don't have a high school diploma, that's one thing, and childcare. I mean, those are two issues that are huge for people working. Now, looking at the other side, by the way, I am not advocating for anything here. I'm just asking the questions of what
right,
people may have.
Me too.
But, you know, the other side could say, well, I can understand someone receiving SNAP benefits if they need to get their GED, but should taxpayers be footing the bill for someone to go to college or while they're going to college or getting some type of certificate?
Well, and that's why this is a fascinating topic, I think, and sort of a perennial one, because when we talk about it, we're not just talking about a proposal or a bill or a, you know, some sort of legislative effort. What we're really talking about is fundamentally what you believe about, you know, how you can change your circumstances and how much control you have over your circumstances. You know, so for example, with regard to this concept of able-bodied adult without dependents, that makes it sound as if, perhaps at first glance, everybody on that in that category would be on the same playing field of opportunity. Secretary Miller, I know, points out that just because a person is in that category doesn't mean that they're all going to be have the same, you know, the same opportunity or the same
circumstances. Yeah.
And so even without, you know, going too far into the more subjective things, you could really point out very specific things like you don't have transportation and you live in a rural county. That's a big barrier for a lot of people. You may be taking care of a sick person who isn't your dependent, but it's part of sort of what you do. So, you know, that's part of the discussion or part of the sort of different. And the other thing is, it's who you see as, I mean, I think as a legislator, who you see as your the people you're looking out for. A lot of the Republican efforts to constantly work at slashing Medicaid costs, you know, it is one of the single costliest aspects of the budget. It is arguably also one of the most important for many people in Pennsylvania. They're trying to, you know, keep it trimmed down as much as they can at the benefit of the general overall taxpayer. And we can get into some other interesting aspects of that as well, because that effort kind of leads to some interesting results that don't just target, I think, you know, Pennsylvanians or people, but also can target companies. And that's the case with them.
Go ahead. What do you mean?
Well, all right. So I did a story a few weeks ago. It's about pharmacy benefit managers. And there's now a legislative effort also underway to look into what they do as another way to potentially save costs on Medicaid. So again, it goes back to sort of the efforts to rein in some of the Medicaid spending. And pharmacy benefit managers, the average person is going to have absolutely no idea what that is, probably, but I didn't until I started reporting on it. But it's every time a transaction happens between the pharmacy and the drug company, there's a sort of a middle company called a pharmacy benefit manager, and they sort of handle the transaction. And the more that, so the auditor general did a report on this in December that really looked at some practices which he sees as potentially problematic. One of them is called spread pricing, where you would essentially price it in such a way as the pharmacy benefit manager that you were able to take a big chunk of profit out as a sort of middleman. Now, is there anything wrong with that? That's a matter of, I suppose, perspective. When it comes to Medicaid dollars, it's definitely one thing that's driving up costs in a way that both the Auditor General and lawmakers, including it's a Republican-led, but I believe bipartisan effort, but it's led by Republican Lisa Baker, to kind of really investigate pharmacy benefit managers. So again, it's one more way to look at Medicaid spending right now.
You know, described the scenario in my introduction about budget hearings being an opportunity for legislators to kind of divulge their priorities. Oh, yeah. By the questions that they have, and the same way with the agencies and the administration. Nothing like the Michael Cohen hearing last week, where there were a lot of people making speeches.
Right.
In this case, though, asking questions that kind of show what the priorities are. We only have about 2 minutes left. Okay. Were there other aspects of that hearing that stuck out to you that showed what DHS priorities are, legislative priorities?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the big things that's just in the background of every question is that lawmakers are asking is, and the responses from DHS, is the idea of Governor Wolf's plan to raise the minimum wage. And he wants to raise the minimum wage, I think, first to $12 and then eventually to $15. This, again, is something that he's been trying to do for years now. And I don't know, you know, what'll be different this year per se, but that's something that's tied to a lot of DHS's efforts to increase wages for example, child care workers and direct care workers. They're low paid positions. There's a lot of turnover, and there was a lot of compelling testimony from people who basically said, you know, I take my child to this child care worker. I come back, you know, 2 months later, and the person, I've learned their name, and I really liked them.
And the child has.
And the child has
gotten grown comfortable with them.
That's right. And they're gone because these are not sustainable, you know, wages. And so basically, if the minimum wage is increased, then there's $74 million in federal dollars that'll go to increasing child care worker wages. So that's one way to sort of supplement those wages so that the employer doesn't have to take on all those costs to get that wage at least up to $12 an hour. And similarly for direct care workers, a blend of federal and state dollars to the tune of $46 million, I believe it is, would get them up to that wage. So there are a lot of interesting plans out there right now that are sort of tied to the minimum wage. And it goes down to a fundamental, you know, philosophy of whether you believe that, yeah, you know, because Matt, Democratic Chair Matt Bradford said something interesting. He said, you know, part of the thing with subsidizing is you end up subsidizing people with state programs, but that's also because companies have such low wages that, in a way, you're subsidizing companies, was his take on it. So that was a Democratic take on it.
Brett Schultes is WITS Transforming Health reporter. Brett, thanks for the update.
Yeah, thanks for talking.
If you want to take a deeper look at the changing tide of health care, check out WITS Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. Coming up on tomorrow's program, you're probably hearing a lot about hemp here in Pennsylvania here recently. We're going to be talking a little bit about it, about, it's a new cash crop, what hemp could be used for. It's coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.